Greetings and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard, and this is the second podcast recorded at my home school of St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania, where we are hosting the 6th annual North American Undergraduate Conference in Religion and Philosophy. Joining me now is Joseph Williams, Assistant Professor of Religion at Rutgers University. We will be discussing his new book, Spirit Cure, A History of Pentecostal Healing, published by Oxford University Press in 2013. In it, Professor Williams examines the history of healing practices in Pentecostalism, paying attention to the complex exchanges between members of the faith and everything from mainstream medicine to metaphysical religion. Joseph, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Art.
Well, let me start with the finish. In your epilogue, you write, "From the beginning, Pentecostal spirituality radiated a pragmatic malleability that freed participants to utilize and assimilate key features of modern U.S. culture." Please elaborate, because I think this is a good place to start a conversation.
Part of what I find fascinating about Pentecostal healing is it really just an incredible example of just how practical, just how pragmatic and innovative Pentecostals have been over the 20th century and into the 21st century. And because here you have Pentecostal healing, which is at the heart of the tradition. Even some historians would highlight that healing, you know, rivals tongues in some ways as, you know, being central to Pentecostal identity. And despite its centrality, it's going to evolve in just an incredible amount of ways, an incredible number of ways. You're going to have it, believers exchanging and interacting with mainstream medicine, with alternative forms of healing, with psychology, and adapting to all these different traditions. And it's just a phenomenal example of, again, this pragmatic, practical adaptability within the tradition.
So in using that language, we hear definitely Grant Wacker's categories of primitive and pragmatic at work in Pentecostalism. And I'm wondering, because he, you know, endorsed your book and you obviously have a debt to him, but where do you take that thinking in this book?
To situate this in particular with his work, and when he talks about the pragmatic in the early days of Pentecostalism, he'll often stress the way in which it was very much present, it was right below the surface, and it was something that was a powerful shaping force on early Pentecostalism. But again, it wasn't something that was usually acknowledged, it wasn't something that was consciously expressed. The much more supernatural, primitive impulse was what was at the forefront of Pentecostal rhetoric. I think what's fascinating about Pentecostal healing is as believers start to interact with mainstream medicine, psychology, etc., this is forcing a much more explicit, much more open engagement with this pragmatic strain. And so what I see happening over the course of the 20th century with figures like Oral Roberts and others is they're very intentionally trying to take this emphasis on healing, and especially supernatural healing, and very intentionally combining it with practical scientific forms of healing. And so you basically see what was beneath the surface becoming much more open, much more part of the official rhetoric as they, again, try to transform the disciplines of, you know, psychology, medicine, alternative healing, and combine it with this supernatural strain. So I basically see that primitive and pragmatic dynamic becoming much more explicit, and Pentecostals wrestling with that dynamic in a much more explicit fashion over the course of the 20th century.
I want to start where Pentecostalism starts, and that is Azusa Street, right? And what was the discussion of healing then?
Well, I mean, anyone who's kind of studied the history of Pentecostalism knows that they saw themselves as reviving the early church. In fact, you have these great comments, these great quotes from some of the early Pentecostals where they basically say they're skipping the intervening history of Christianity since the time of the New Testament, and they're basically taking the New Testament model, you know, the examples from the book of Acts, and inserting them directly into the 20th century. And so in their eyes, they basically see themselves as, you know, taking what they see as this emphasis on faith healing in the Gospels, emphasis on spiritual warfare in the process of healing, and just bring it right into the 20th century. Of course, we know that they're being shaped in very powerful ways by American culture and by specific trends, and that they're adapting in all sorts of ways. But in their minds, again, this is just the New Testament brought to the 20th century.
And what's interesting is you even look at somebody like Charles Parham, and you start to see a rhetoric that is looking an awful lot like New Thought.
In some ways, Parham is a bit of a unique example, because if you look at some of his early writings, you actually get this language that almost seems like it's directly borrowed from New Thought. He talks about the waves of wisdom, that this becomes something that believers can access. And so in some ways, he is a bit of a unique example. But in other ways, I think you can say, in a much more general fashion, Pentecostals are going to talk especially about the Holy Spirit in ways that are very impersonal quite frequently, and that are going to mimic some of these other, what I call, metaphysical traditions that's associated with New Thought, or you see these kind of trends in homeopathy and chiropractic medicine. And there's a real parallel in terms of their impersonal descriptions of the Holy Spirit. And it kind of creates a very powerful connection, I think, that's going to lay the groundwork for the later change in the dramatic transitions that you see, in, especially by the second half of the 20th century.
What happens in the kind of post-World War II period that enables Pentecostalism and Pentecostal healing to get a little bit more mainstream?
I'd say there's definitely at least three very significant factors that are laying the groundwork for this transition. One is just going to be the sheer success of mainstream medicine. I think it's hard for us to get our minds around now. We're just, when we live in U.S. culture that is so powerfully influenced and dominated by mainstream medicine in so many respects. But, you know, in the early 20th century, that wasn't really quite the case yet. You haven't seen antibiotics yet. You don't really haven't had some of the dramatic surgeries that are become possible by the mid-century. But as those successes come along, mainstream medicine is going to gain incredible power, incredible social influence, and it becomes much more difficult for Pentecostals to just write off mainstream medicine as something that's irrelevant, doesn't work. And so in some ways, I think that's one of the biggest factors that's driving this transition is they just can no longer write off mainstream medicine as something that's an illegitimate alternative. In addition, another very important issue is you have Pentecostals' demographics are changing and they're moving up the social ladder. And so this is going to diminish some of the class-based tension with physicians. And so I think that plays an extremely important role. And then finally, with the arrival of the charismatic movement and the spread of Pentecostal-style emphases among mainstream denominations, this is going to bring a lot of people into contact with Pentecostals who lack the anti-medicine, anti-psychology baggage that Pentecostals bring to the conversation. And so again, this is also just going to just spur these changes along. And I think really, in my mind, those are three of the absolutely crucial issues that are going to help transition things.
Let me pick up on psychology then, because what you say about how Pentecostals use this discipline, you say that, quote, Freud would not have been happy. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that.
Well, I guess in that case, I wasn't trying to make too profound of a statement there, other than anyone who's read Freud knows he wasn't thrilled with religion. He saw it as famously referred to it as an illusion. And basically, here you have this discipline that Freud is so closely associated with, psychotherapy, psychology. And to have, you know, religious figures, obviously Pentecostals and Charismatic weren't the only ones doing this, but it brought into conversation with religion in such an explicit way. I just don't see Freud as being happy with that.
Let's jump ahead then to where this comes into in, you know, more recent years. You talk about Joyce Meyer, T.D. Jakes, Paula White, Joel Osteen. What did these folks bring to the story that's new and unique?
All right. In many respects, I see them as kind of the great popularizers of this more mental form of healing within the Pentecostal charismatic tradition. In the chapter where I address mental forms of healing, I talk especially about the initial importance of an inner healing movement, which is very explicitly grappling with psychology and how to incorporate a Christian form of psychological healing. I also talk about the Word of Faith movement and the way in which they're drawing on New Thought emphases and this emphasis on positive confession. And basically what I see figures like Meyer and Osteen and Jakes and others doing is drawing in some ways from both of those camps. Very much you get a real strong sense of this kind of self-help, popular psychological discussion in a lot of their writings and a lot of their presentations. And you also get a real strong tie-in with the Word of Faith emphasis on positive confession in their works as well. And I really see them as becoming just extremely successful in combining those themes into something that can appeal broadly. Obviously, not just to Pentecostals, not just to Charismatics, but it's something that's going to really get this mental form of healing deeply embedded within the movement. And they've been quite successful at it.
Well, it seems to be that this isn't just a mind thing. It's a body thing too. So diet and exercise starts to figure into this story. So tell me what somebody like Don Colbert's self-help books, Toxic Relief and What Would Jesus Eat? What does that bring to this?
So Colbert's a really fascinating figure in many respects. So he has a Baptist background. He goes to Oral Roberts University, and he ends up, like you said, writing this book like Toxic Relief. And what you see here is a great example of the ways that some of the early rhetoric surrounding healing is going to transition as Pentecostals and Charismatics grapple with some of their rivals on the American healing scene. And so what you'll see here is that early language of spiritual warfare doesn't disappear, but when someone like Colbert's writing, you do see how it gets transposed and how some of these figures are taking this notion of spiritual warfare, and all of a sudden it's more about fighting toxins in the body and fighting, again, these kind of dangers in the environment that are attacking them and ruining health. But what I love about Colbert, though, is in one sense he illustrating this transition in the notions of spiritual warfare and how to attack healing. But he's actually promoted by and in close association with Benny Hinn, who, of course, has this very dramatic form of healing. And you kind of, if you've watched any of his healing crusades on TV or whatnot, you know, it's full of confronting demons, confronting Satan and so forth as he battles for healing on behalf of individuals. But this close association between Colbert and Hinn, in fact, Colbert was seen at, I don't know if Benny Hinn would still say this, but I believe Hinn would refer to Colbert as his personal doctor. And so here you have a great example of the coexistence of these two streams, with the transitions within the movement of healing becoming much more about fighting toxins and you know, incorporating natural dietary methods of healing, but it's coexisting right alongside this much more dramatic supernatural form of healing that has a very close tie into the early movement.
And it seems to me, too, all of these folks we're talking about now have a kind of massive marketing campaign, and it looks like, to me, they're making a lot of money out of this. Is that unique?
I don't know if it's unique, but I definitely see, especially within the, because there's obviously a lot of people making a lot of money off of healing products throughout American culture. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. But specifically within even the evangelical world, I do think it's fair to say that a lot of these Pentecostal and charismatic figures have been at the forefront of commoditizing healing. And that, again, part of the argument of the book is arguing that because Pentecostals were able to see and often depicted the Holy Spirit in a more impersonal fashion, this helped lay the groundwork for these conceptions of healing that were seen as much more predictable, much more manipulable, and something that, again, ultimately could be marketed right alongside some of what you see in the vitamin shop or these other products that are inundating the U.S. market.
I'm wondering how you think Pentecostalism's global presence is going to influence its healing practices.
Well, I think one thing that's already very, very clear, just based on some of the research that's been done, is just how central healing is to the global growth of Pentecostalism. In fact, there's a really fascinating study done by the Pew Center a few years back where they looked at the various beliefs and practices of Pentecostals and charismatics worldwide, and they basically found that healing was a much more frequently experienced by individuals than even like speaking in tongues or something along those lines. So I do think healing has been incredibly influential in the spread and the growth of Pentecostal-style religion over the past several decades. I mean, what's fascinating then is to see then how it gets incorporated into the various cultures and into the various settings that it arrives in. And again, part of what my work is trying to focus on is, again, here in the U.S., that there's been just as much adaptation to American culture as what you've seen, say, you know, Pentecostalism and Pentecostal-style forms of religiosity, you know, adapting to situations in Africa or South Korea or, you know, all over the globe, and that same type of adaptation has been definitely happening here in the U.S.
Last question before we let you go. What are you working on next?
Well, my next project is focusing especially on Pentecostal conceptions of prophecy, both in terms of end times prophecy, but also personal prophecy and the ways that has evolved over the course of the 20th century. And I'm very interested especially in what that can help tell us about Pentecostal's unique contributions to evangelicalism and the formation of evangelicalism.
Well, with that, we will conclude this podcast. Again, the book is Spirit Cure, A History of Pentecostal Healing. Thank you to Joseph Williams for joining us, and thank you for listening. Have a great day.